Robert, Rob Gell, Access Environmental. I was interested that the first two countries that you mentioned who had whose economies were changing and showing some growth were Japan and Germany. And I'm also aware that Japan and Germany are probably the two leading sustainability economies in the world, moving very strongly into the sort of technologies that we're going to need to have a sustainable world. I really want to delve in and see whether that was discussed at Davos and see how the World Economic Forum understands or understands for those broader issues.
The environment has been discussed at this World Economic Forum since before it even became a big subject. They've really been very big in this whole area. And this year was no... I think I wouldn't say any more this year. What I found interesting was that they tried to take the debate one step further and try and see where this is all going to head. And yes, sure, you had sessions on Kyoto and things like that, but the big change coming in the environment is the Chinese, because I think it's... they're certainly very large polluters in terms of your actual experience in China. And so for their own well-being, they are setting about reducing carbon emissions on a dramatic scale. And they mightn't have Kyoto objectives and stuff like that, but I think it's fairly likely that everywhere we've seen the Chinese move, whether it be in mobile phones or in television sets or things like that, because of their enormous scale, they in fact set the world agenda for those sort of products. And already we're starting to see that this might be exactly what takes place in the environment. But because they're going to tackle this environmental exercise on a huge scale, they will in fact be world pace setters for many of the developments.
If there's not a follow-up question, then what advice do you have for the Australian government on that issue?
I think probably we ought to sign the Kyoto Treaty, because that puts us into the loop, and it means that we are actually meeting the Kyoto objectives anyway. It'll have no particular relevance initially. And the reason to do that is that there's a huge industry starting out there in environmental products, and we can't be involved in that if we're outside that treaty. But the treaty itself is not a good treaty. Be very clear about that. It's a treaty that was designed by Europeans, and it's not a well-conceived treaty at all. But you might need to be in it to in fact be part of a growth business. And you really need, I think, to work with the Chinese, make sure that... currently we're working with the Americans. We need to work with the Chinese because we'll want to try and develop in Australia environmental industries, whether it be coal burning research, whether it be nuclear research, because we're a very big supplier of uranium, whether it be waste management of nuclear, whether it be water management. The big market for these sort of things is going to be China. So if China needs us to be in Kyoto to deal with this happily, well, then let's do so. But you need to tackle it from a very pragmatic point of view. Don't come out there and say that Kyoto is a great treaty and stuff like that. It's a dreadful treaty. It's a notice of intent. No. Start to think about your own particular situation and how you dovetail in with our biggest trading partner in resources. It's changing its direction. We need to make sure that we button into that. And that may require us to sign Kyoto. But that's the sort of consideration you make.
Thank you. The next question is on Robert's left.
Thank you. Geraldine Gentle from URS Economics and Policy. Robert, I'm interested to follow up on this in terms of the implications of the growth in the Chinese domestic economy and the implications of that. You've spoken about the implications of their shifting their international focus. to the oil producers, but to the extent that they're also looking to spread the benefits of development into the domestic economy, there could be implications, significant implications from that.
Absolutely. And right now, we have been great beneficiaries from the first five-year plan, or not the, the most recent five-year plan, because it was just down our, up our alley. They were going to use vast amounts of commodities. So what will this new growth in China mean as they lift their standard of living? Well, you can see two businesses that are going to grow dramatically and are going to boom beyond all belief. And you don't have to be Einstein to work out the first one. It's tourism. You'll remember that when we started our China free trade talks, the Chinese said to us at the very first meeting, how many tourists do you want? Do you want 1 million? 2 million? 3 million? Just tell us. You have them. And so have no doubt about that as a boom industry. The Chinese haven't had credit cards. But as you increase their standard of living, the other one I think that probably will be a growth industry, although the Chinese might do it themselves, well, obviously will do it themselves, but education. We'll need to watch that carefully, but the likelihood is the Chinese will want to send lots of people here. Now, right now, we've decided that Adelaide is the place where our education should take place. And that was a decision made by the Adelaide Minister for Immigration. I exaggerate, and my friend from RIT will say that's a lot of rubbish because he's doing well, and that's fair enough. But other universities you talk to say we could have a lot more Chinese students. In fact, we could fill the place with Chinese students if we gave them citizenship. And Adelaide is allowed to do that. Now, that again exaggerates because you get more points for your citizenship if you go to an Adelaide University than if you go to a Melbourne University. And that's simply because that's where the Minister for Immigration lives and she wants votes. The pretext is that Adelaide is a regional centre. And so regional centres give you more points for citizenship than big capital cities. It's just a nonsense. You either want them as citizens or you don't. And if you do want them, then they should better go to Sydney, Melbourne or Brisbane or anything like that. There's some issues there that we need to think about, but education could be quite a major beneficiary.
You've got my vote on that one, Robert. Yes. The next question's over here.
Yeah. Norm Wall, Monash University. Robert, last year one of the discussions at Davos was the issue of uranium and copper.
Yes.
And today you've just told us a little bit about oil and the importance of that. I was wondering if you had any comments about the central player in both debates at the moment. Iran,
oh, yeah. Iran clearly is beginning to see the power that it does have, the pivotal power it has in the Middle East, because of its links with Hamas, its links with the Shiites in Iraq, and it's cash. And yet, the previous government in Iran, the current guys got to power simply because they said, we're going to give you some money, and we've got plenty to give you. And it was a straight... the people in Iran were not benefiting from their oil bonanza, and this guy said, I'm going to give you benefits. And, of course, he had other tags to him as well. I don't have any simple answers. I'll just throw you a couple of thoughts. We asked one of the Republican congressmen in the US whether he thought America would put a would really cut up rough in Iran, and define that as you want. But a ban on all trade with Iran might be a good way of starting, you see. That means that the price of oil will rise. And it happens that there's a congressional election coming at the end of the year, and a big rise in the price of oil would not be a good thing for Republicans. No, that won't happen. it was suggested. Treat the answer with a grain of salt, but it gets mixed up with US domestic politics. So that's that question. The second thing that is really important is that Russia, you can see the Russian communist revolution collapsed partly because of communism itself and partly because, relatively speaking, they were a high-cost oil producer and the oil price slumped. They didn't have any cash. Now they've got it running out their ears and they're exercising power. They've got a lot more oil, they've got a lot more gas, and you can see them sort of becoming a broker. US is caught up in Iraq, and I don't know the final end in Iran. I don't know how it all turns out, but you can see those forces there, not, let alone the business of Iran financing the US. One more thing, though. Don't write off Hamas. At the dinner, the Sunnis were there, there was a guy there from the Palestinian Investment Corporation, and he was flying to Palestine next day. Hamas had just won the election. And he thought there was a really good chance that they would, in fact, do certain things. He didn't know them very well, but he said they're honest. The other guys weren't. There was a very good chance that over a 6 month period they'll do what's required. And that's important because Iran, of course, is linked into Hamas quite closely. And the West would be very stupid to really throw Hamas into the Iran cauldron to make it even worse. And finally, the most fearful thing is that if Iran gets control of Iraq, then that's control of a very big portion of our global oil, let alone the capital to keep America going. You can get very scary about the scenarios in Iran as time goes on. I don't have any particularly good insights from Iran that says there's a hope of the whole thing turning around. I suspect not. The Russians are probably the best chance that they will find a way through the whole exercise.
Another question over here.
Robert, Bill McCard, Colliers International. I've been in business almost as long as you have, Robert, and I'm used to the cycle. And I'm just wondering if you've got any feedback from Davos in terms of the likely sustainability of the good times the world has enjoyed in recent years, and from what you're saying, the anticipation for the future. I'm told the four most dangerous words in our vocabulary are, this time it's different. Is it different this time? And if it is different, what is going to do it? Is it the weight of money? Is it sustained low interest rates? And if something's going to spoil the party, what do you expect it to be?
Okay, this is a debate between Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. In Davos they had this debate, and if you've read my stuff in The Australian, I set all that out, that this was the debate. Exactly as you described, Goldman Sachs people say it's going to keep going. And this is more bullish than they've ever seen. And yes, these things can go wrong, but we don't think it'll happen. Steve Roach at Morgan Stanley says, yeah, you've got that wrong. What's going to happen is that the US consumer is going to get bitten in some way, shape or form. Probably by rising interest rates in the US or by oil prices or something, and it'll start at that point. But the US consumer is the weak point in this whole exercise. And that if the US consumer slows their spending, that comes through into China and so on. Now, you can argue that there could be a political revolution in China. You can argue that some other world catastrophe, like a huge disaster of some sort, will upset the whole balance of things. On the Morgan Stanley criteria, they say US consumer is the key. And if they stop spending, then woe betide China and all those dependent on the whole Chinese exercise. And then you have to say, well, what would stop the US consumer stop spending? We know oil. We think we know that oil substantially above $70. We think we know that if US interest rates, long-term bond rate, got above 5%, it might knock things around a bit in the housing market. But whatever it takes to knock it around. Of course, if the US dollar slumped because the oil producers didn't put the money into the states, that would push up inflation. And the US Federal Reserve chief is a real hawk on inflation, the new guy. There's some of the thoughts that that could bring it on. Iran can bring it on. Iran, that whole exercise could bring it on. But for what it's worth, Morgan Stanley say the best, the most risky situation at present is the US consumer, who has been spending far more than they earn on the basis of the higher houses. And if something goes wrong with the higher houses, they'll have to cut it back, and they'll cut it back sharply. And when they do that, it means we demand less Chinese goods and therefore less iron ore.
So they're the arguments. What's the consensus from Davos?
Was the consensus from Davos was Goldman Sachs.
Which was? Sorry.
The bulls. The clear consensus in Davos was that this was going to keep going. At least the next year, anyway. Then we'll have a new Davos to work it out, you see.
Sounds like a very good reason for going back. Okay, do we have any more questions, please? Gentlemen over here.
Peter Duncan, Rob, just picking up on one of your side remarks, which I think you used the expression political revolution in China. Out of Davos or elsewhere, do you have a view on how long China can continue the process of rushing into a modern market economy while maintaining an authoritarian system of government?
I think the Chinese view of that is that we have to give tangible... We can keep doing this as long as we give tangible gains. And the weakness in our... And maybe they're wrong about that hypothesis, that no matter how many, the more gains you give, the more there'll be demands for democracy, or some form of democracy. And that's probably right. But the Chinese view is that our great danger is Western China, where they... basically, Chinese have got, that's just the argument, 1.2 billion, 400 million have benefited, 800 million haven't. 800 million haven't. And most of those who haven't are on the other side. And they've got to do something about that, or it'll break down the whole exercise. They can't keep repressing those people on the West forever without giving them some increases in the standard of living. And that's why that five-year plan has been targeted in that way. Another little side game is that the US are pressing China to increase the value of its currency. They can't do that too quickly because they've got all these hedge funds in there, or the equivalent of hedge funds, and speculating on the currency, and they've bought all these Chinese properties. And if they actually put the currency up too far, there's no one in these properties. They're just sitting there in Shanghai empty. And they'll just flog them and take the currency gain, and it'll knock the whole property market. As it is, the Chinese share market hasn't risen a great deal since the fell in 2004, and only rose a little bit in 2005. So they're the issues as far as China is concerned, as they would see it. I just say one more thing, though. We've been forecasting the demise and possible demise of China now for a long time, and they themselves say doing what we're trying to do is like skating on ice, but they never seem to fall. They seem to get it right, and my money would be on that they continue to do so.
Do we have one last question, please? Let me ask one then, Robert. When you came back from Davos, let's hypothesise you had a few minutes with the Prime Minister, and you wanted to tell him, as a result of everything you'd heard, three things that he should do. What would they be?
Oh, it's a rotten thing. Let me finish, too. firstly, what's your relationship with George Bush? Because we've got our defence on the one hand, and the US, and our trade relationship with China. we've got a balancing act here, and we're always going to have this balancing act. Just be careful we don't get caught up too much in the US side of it at a time when the US is having difficulties. Secondly, I'd say to him, you mightn't realise this, but we're in an arms race in our region. And the Chinese are spending an absolute fortune on defence. You saw Condoleezza Rice talk about it. The Indians are doing it. The Indonesians are doing it. And unfortunately, we're stuffing our defence up. And there's no doubt about that now. Even some of the members of Parliament on the Liberal side, are now saying this. And unfortunately, the bloke who made most of the mistakes is now in charge of the whole, a fellow called Houston, who's in charge of it. And we're stuffing up the Air Force, because what we did was we punted on a Joint Strike Fighter, which the US quite open now that it's not going to be available for quite some time, and we're relying on the replacement, an aircraft which is just simply outclassed by the Russian aircraft. We can update it if we want to, but they can update theirs. This is the F-17, I think it is. And unfortunately, what we had to do was to modernise our F-111 and in that interim period, or probably buy the F-22, which the Americans want us to buy. And so, John, you've got to get into that defence area. And finally, which I'm not sure, but education is terribly important. We're going to have a smart country to live in the sort of environment that we've got now. And we have a particular problem, both in America and Australia, that our primary and secondary education systems are based on pen and ink. And the VCE and Year 12 exams are based on pen and ink. And we have to change that. We have to bring that. I can't tell you how to do that, but you've got to change that. And I would actually advise him in 12 months' time, assuming he's still there, and he probably will be, to go off to New Orleans. Not to see the flood damage repair, but to see the tremendous benefit that Katrina has going to deliver American education. Because one of the great things that happened about Katrina was it blew all the schools down, killed a lot, which meant that they had a chance to start again, and the teacher unions didn't stop them, the teacher authorities. And they're actually going to start a modern education system based on technology. It works, and it's absolutely fabulous for boys and for poorer people, because particularly poorer boys, because they're inspired to learn where the current system doesn't inspire them to learn at all. And we took away the disciplinary systems that made them learn in the old days. We just take them away from school now. So technology is terribly important in primary and secondary education. And I'm not saying we're behind America, because they've got the same problems as us, but we are way behind what is allowable and what we can do. Thanks.
Thank you, Robert, for those insights. I'd now like to invite Rob Skinner, Managing Director, Melbourne Water, to propose the vote of thanks.